So I also want to begin by thanking Tobias and Jim and other organizers, but especially all the participants in this workshop. It's really been great. I'm leaving this evening with a heavy heart because it's been so great, and I would really rather stay another 2 weeks, but my family calls. So this is going to take off from the tutorial I gave last time on the cocktail party, where I did talk about cocktail party separation and processing of speech. This is going to focus much less on the cocktail party and much more just on representations of speech in auditory cortex in humans. I know that at some point I'm going to be way behind, so I'm going to start off with the acknowledgments. Everyone in red has contributed to either this work in this talk or the past one, and most of it was also funded by NIDCD. And so I'll talk about cortical representations of speech as measured by MEG. I'll talk a little bit more than last time about the difference between encoding models and decoding models, but I think both of them are important if we're going to talk about neural representations. I'll talk about speech and noise and how that affects the cortical representations or not, and then recent results, aging, the effect of higher level interference. In this case, it's whether a background speaker is speaking a language you know or a language you don't know. I'll talk a little bit more about foreground and background and different kinds of background representations. And then at the very end, hope to get to speech restoration. I was going to talk a little bit more about MEG, but I think that's not so interesting. I'm just going to run through these slides so that to remind everyone that if I say something about MEG that doesn't make sense with what they know about EEG or single unit recordings or perception or anything else, just please stop me and I'll talk about that. But until then, I'll assume that you will ask questions when they occur. Okay, so these are typical MEG responses to a pure tone or to broadband noise. It's hard to represent three-dimensional responses as a function of time on a two-dimensional screen. So what's often done, these are called butterfly plots. You can just see all of the channels responding along the same zero axis. And when not much is going on, there's really no point in showing anything. But when there's clearly a large increase in the RMS or the variance of the activity, then that's probably a good time to show what the magnetic field distributions are. And that's where you would then start doing localization. When the SNR is poor, then localization is probably pointless. When the SNR is high, that's when you expect to be able to say something about where and how the processing is going on. And this is just going to show that different kinds of sounds will create different kinds of activities at different times with different latencies. The latencies here, in this case for broadband noise, you can see these two are similar but not the same. And that's because the sources, the currents at 50 milliseconds and 150 milliseconds latency are in the same directions, but they're in different places. They're different neural sources in cortex. And if you ever want to go back to the whole head, then you picture something like this. So moving to speech right away, here's a nice speech spectrogram. When we want to talk about representations of speech in the brain, we certainly have the speech, we have the brain, we have in red here some neural responses, but one representative one here. But to talk about a representation, we have to have some sort of model. What do we mean by representation? We don't want to just map the response from one subject to this speech. We want to have some understanding of what the underlying processing is. And we call that whatever that understanding is, an auditory model. The one that I'll be using is a linear model. It's linear with respect to the spectrotemporal envelope. That means since we have a two-dimensional spectrotemporal envelope here, and we're having a one-dimensional response time waveform, and in fact we have to integrate over time to get there, we need some sort of at least two-dimensional kernel, and what we'll do is we'll convolve in the time direction, and we'll just sum or take the trace in the spectral dimension. With MEG, we don't have enough resolution to be able to do much with the spectral information except integrate over it. Some scales here, the typical stimulus duration we'll use is 60 seconds. That way we don't have to integrate over trials. Because we're doing convolutions in time, we're integrating over time, so to speak, instead. The frequency content of these kernels goes up to about 10 hertz, and I'll show you why in a bit. And I should mention also how we compute these kernels. There's any number of ways to compute a kernel like this, to estimate a kernel. The one we use, because we're always using speech and one has to be a little bit careful about normalizing with respect to the stimulus, autocorrelations if you're doing an ordinary reverse correlation, we use this method called boosting. Boosting is pretty intuitive. We take the speech stimulus, convolve it with a candidate STRF. And we'll start off in the initial case, our candidate STRF is just blank. It's just nothing, it's zeros. And that will give us a prediction. That prediction, when we start off, will be pretty poor. So what we'll do is we will take the STRF we started off with, which was all zeros now, and we'll pick one pixel to add to. And we'll look at all the possible places we can add one on this. And the one that does best, that's our new STRF. And then we iterate. And so eventually, we stop getting doing any better, and that's when we stop. And so this gives us STRFs that have somewhat of a sparse prior to them, because we don't keep, once we can't do any better, we stop immediately. We could keep adding things and not get any worse, but we don't do that.
But then the prediction is done on unseen data, right? So you do a cross-validation effect.
Correct. It's all done with cross-validation. Yeah. We do 90-10. We have 90% of the data to generate this. We test it on the other 10%, and we average over all rotations. This is where the 10 hertz comes from. So if we're using monaural stimuli, either only left ear or only right ear, we can look at how well we can do in terms of predicting what the response is, just in terms of a straight correlation. And here we're doing this using two hertz bands of the stimulus. And we can see that in this case, when we use two hertz centered on one, two hertz centered on three, et cetera, we can do okay. But once we get up to two hertz centered on nine, then we can't do anything we can do in terms of prediction is all in the noise. If we're looking in the right hemisphere, then there's a much, we can do much better actually. There's a stronger signal, stronger neural SNR, and stronger ability to predict what the response is going to be. And we can get also now up to, in this case, it's 11 hertz before we're totally in the noise. And so when I say that we can only go up to 10 hertz, this is what I mean. Beyond this, there's nothing helpful in the responses that we can use to generate a kernel to predict those responses. You can also see here that we have this, not too surprising for some people who study speech processing, there's a right hemisphere advantage, which would turn into a left ear advantage if you look at the cross connections.
Is it fair to use a 2 hertz window as you go to higher frequencies? So you could imagine something that scales with the center frequency bandwidth. It probably doesn't matter for these kind of plots.
Yes, so it may or may not be fair, and one doesn't know until one does it. But if you also expand it as you go out, it doesn't help.
So John, this is done with modulation filtering? This is modulation frequency that is on that axis, right?
No, this is MEG frequency.
So you're filtering the MEG signal in different bands and doing this exercise and then looking at that. Okay.
Exactly.
And is that R or R?
This is R. Yeah, so it shouldn't be power. And these axes will change a little bit as I go through these slides, because we use slightly different ways of estimating the kernels, and we got a little better. So These things now at 0.1 and 0.2 have now in our lab steadied out at about 0.3.
So just to, before you come on, you can generate, you see this general phenomenon, and like you're using all sounds. All sounds are cooking to create these spheres and then to see the biases. So you don't only see the right hemisphere bias with vocalizations, you see it with all sounds.
This is only for speech.
It's only for speech.
Only for speech. This data set.
Have you done it for other sounds? Do you still get that strong right here? My hemisphere bias?
I have not done it for other sounds presented monaurally. We don't see this when the sounds are presented diodically. It's only when they're presented monaurally. If they're left only ear, we see this. If they're right only, we see this. If they're presented diodically, same in both ears, we do not see a right hemisphere advantage. Another way of talking about how good these representations are is to ask how much information is encoded or can be discovered in this. So here we do a pretty simple model. We break our 60 seconds into, in this case, it's 50 1.2 second bins. And we ask, given the stimulus and the response, which any possible response of those 50 bins, which one, how good is that correlation? And that's just all the colors. And then the one that is the best, we put a square there. And so you can see that when we've broken up into 50 1.2 second blocks, this is in the right hemisphere, that it's pretty diagonal, and there are a few cases where it's off. We can do that as a function of how many segments we want and how long those durations are. And so then we can break that up into stimuli per second. And when we do that in terms of the decoding accuracy, measured by roughly how much power there is in the diagonal, in the right hemisphere we get the red dots, in the blue hemisphere we get, sorry, in the left hemisphere we get the blue dots, and then we can just compare this with the Fano inequality. And so the 4 bits per second Fano bound is this magenta piecewise linear curve. The light green one is the 1 bit per second. And so just from that, we can see that the right hemisphere is giving us about 4 bits per second, left hemisphere about 1 bits per second, in terms of how many sentence fragments we're able to, when we compare to a certain number of sentence fragments, how many we're going to get right.
How long are the fragments?
So in this case, it's always 60 seconds worth of data. So if in this case it was 1.2 second duration, and that gave us 50 of them. When it's two, then there's two, two stimuli per second, these are 30 seconds in duration. When we're close to 30, then there are 2 seconds in duration. Oh, this should be per minute. No, wait, hold on a sec.
Two minute.
No. So I got that wrong. So this really is 2 per second. 128 per second. Everything I'm saying now says that should be per minute. Yeah, okay. These are per minute, but these are bits per second. So this is wrong. These are right. Yeah, actually, I took this from a pre-publication version. I probably shouldn't have done that. All right, so that's the forward problem. The TRF is used as part of the representation model of mapping the stimulus envelope into the neural responses. Another way of describing the representation is to do the opposite. We can take all of the MEG responses, we'll take 500 millisecond integration windows, come up with a decoder, we also use boosting to do this, to try to reconstruct what the speech envelope was that would have generated these MEG responses.
Yeah.
So I showed this last time. This is what it looks like when you're trying to compare the reconstructed speech envelope with the actual envelope. But basically, this is the general message. We take 500 millisecond time windows, and we use that to try to reconstruct what the speech envelope was. And this shows data, but I didn't actually show this slide last time. This is when we look at reconstruction of the attended speech, what the correlation is when we're looking at the, let's see. So in this case, we're using the attended speech reconstruction filter, and we're applying that, we're always applying that to the response, to the MEG neural responses, but then that predicts a particular stimulus, and we can correlate that stimulus that we've predicted with either the actual attended speech or the unattended speech. And so we can see that we do much, much better, and this was the 92% that I showed last time. We can do the same thing with the reconstruction filter that we would generate to determine what the background speech was. And we do better, we're more successful using that background filter with the background than with the foreground. But we can see also that it's not as good.
Can you learn anything about looking at the foreground and the attended and background filters?
We haven't seen much. We've looked and not seen. One of the items I'll show in recent results will give you a little bit more insight to that. But even in that, we don't look at the spatial composition.
That 0.2 sounds low. Does that correspond to the what you had illustrated on the previous slide? I guess that would look like pretty good correlation.
Yeah. So and again, in current studies, that goes up to about 0.3. But yeah, it's 0.2. So we're getting, in terms of the square of that, we're not getting much of the variance explained.
That correspond to the picture you showed us that looked like it had a much better correlation?
Absolutely not. The picture does not correspond to this at all. That picture was 0.6 probably.
Was that real data in the picture?
It was real data, but it was a very carefully chosen fragment of the real data.
Because
if I had chosen you 0.2, it would have been anti-compelling.
Yeah.
But seriously, the 0.2 matters because it's very consistent, it's robust. Even with EEG, when this 0.2 can become 0.1, it can become 0.05, it can become less than 0.05. I see heads nodding. As long as it's consistent, it's still useful.
If you were to reconstruct, let's say, the mixture of sounds based on the mixture of sounds to create your filters, this reconstruction, do you think it would be higher than the background reconstruction here?
Please hold that question because it's a really good one and I will answer it later in the talk. So this was a somewhat naive reconstruction. We just asked which one of the speakers are we interested in reconstructing. All right, so that's the general picture. All of that was done in two slides in my tutorial talk. So now you've seen a little bit more about speech representations in cortex using MEG. So now we're going to add noise. We're just going to add stationary noise. So in this experiment, we had speech in quiet and then at five different SNRs. And here's four examples from those six cases. No noise added, 6 dB SNR down to minus 9 dB SNR. You can see that as more noise is added, then the spectrotemporal structure starts disappearing into the noise. What we did here was we just constructed what we think is an intuitive index, which is this contrast index. We just looked at the power, peak power divided by, I don't remember what the actual definition was, but it's roughly speaking, it's the contrast that you see here when you look at the marginal of these STRFs. So this corresponds to the quiet, which was 12 dB higher in contrast than the minus 3, which is here. So we've got this nice linear useful index, which is nothing except the acoustics. Now, what we also did was we asked the listeners to judge the intelligibility of the speech and this noise for 60 seconds worth of noise.
In the background, is it speech babble or speech or something?
It's spectrally matched stationary noise.
Stationary noise.
So it's just shh, but it's spectrally matched. It's not white. But there's the only temporal features of the background noise are that comes from making stationary noise. So the psychophysics for intelligibility of 60-second speech fragments is far behind what we'd like to do. So we can ask, and we do ask, certain factual questions about what they're listening to. They're actually listening to stories. We can ask them to count the number of occurrences of a particular keyword. But what seems to be, and those are both good for seeing whether they were paying attention or not, but they're not so good for intelligibility because there's a lot of words in 60 seconds. And what's worked well for us, for better or for worse, is we ask them how intelligible it is, how much they understand on a scale of 0% to 100%. And they give us a number between 0 and 100. And by that scale, you can see that the intelligibility here does not follow the contrast index. That's not going to surprise anyone. The first few are highly intelligible. The last two are very poorly intelligible. And then around minus 3 dB, there's this sort of sweet spot where it turns out there's a fair amount of variability and disagreement as to how intelligible the speech is there. So what we do with this speech and noise is we try to reconstruct from the MEG neural responses to listeners of the speech and noise, the underlying speech. So not the noise, just the speech. We can do the speech plus the noise, but there's really very little dynamics in the noise, so it's not going to be that different. And we can see that in the plus 6 dB case, we can do a, for this fragment, we do a pretty good job of reconstructing the actual speech envelope. For the same fragment at minus 6 dB, we also do a pretty good job. So changing the SNR, I mean, it's a little presumptuous to say changing it by 12 dB, but changing it from very, very intelligible to minus 6 dB SNR doesn't change our ability to reconstruct the speech envelope much. And we can ask...
Partly just because the reconstruction with plus 6 dB is also partly kind of poor, so then by degrading the sound, it's still going to be poor.
Well, so here's the graph. So this is the clean, that's about 0.2, which is what we were getting before. It really is pretty flat. It's really consistent with there not being any noise as far as our ability to reconstruct the neural modulations, the neural phase locking to the speech envelope.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just saying that 0.2 is still relatively poor state compared to if we did like ECOG or something like that. In terms of the correlation. So then any degradation you see in terms of the reconstruction for a more noisy sound would not really be reflected.
I disagree. This 0.2 is really pretty good. The 0.2 doesn't include, if you square this to get 0.04, that's not explainable variance. So there's a huge amount of variability in the neural responses here from trial to trial that we cannot intrinsically explain. And so part of this is that we can't explain things that vary on a trial to trial.
What would the noise corrected R be, estimate?
No, I can't tell you what it is off the top of my head.
That'd be worth doing.
But I can also tell you that there's a lot of stuff we are missing. And so one of the reasons that it's only 0.2 is because there's many different parts of the brain contributing to this. We're just looking at the response over the entire brain. Different parts of the brain will have different and I'll get at this a little bit, are phase locked to this different representations of the same signal. So the language aware ones will be phase locked to the words. Just before that, to syllables, to phonemes. But where the words begin and end, and where the syllables begin and end, and where the acoustic features are different. And so there's going to be spread based on that as well. So I would say that the 0.2 really is pretty good here. Given that, especially, it should be 0.3, but I think your argument doesn't distinguish between 0.2 and 0.3.
Well, I think we're sort of agreeing the same thing, just different interpretations. You're just saying that the reconstruction for the particular features that you can reconstruct with MEG is still pretty good and they're still relatively conservative, like between +6 and -6 dB. It's just that the things that do disappear between +6 and -6 dB don't show up basically in the reconstruction.
All right, I'll take that. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you think one is intelligibility funds?
Are those standard deviations or are those variances?
If they're standard errors, how big is the variance? Are there people who are fantastic at -3 dB and others who are completely impaired?
These are standard errors.
So does that mean that there's a lot of person-to-person heterogeneity? There are some people who are perfectly fine and some people who are great listeners who are not impaired by...
I'm sorry, the standard errors, you may be hard to see.
I just can't see anything.
Okay. Yeah, so there's a standard error bar that's about the same height as the width of this bar here.
So the variance is?
This is the intelligibility score, which right here is 100.
Right.
So there's no deviation there because everyone got 100. Here, which is the biggest one, the standard error is half an inch.
So the variance is, so there really are some people who are fantastic at -3
yes.
and some people who are terrible.
Exactly. Yes, it really is.
Well, this is self-reporting, right?
It is self-reporting.
It's not really a discrimination. It's just what they say.
But it's really interesting.
Thing number two is we know so much about how ongoing activity affects the way that sounds and other stimuli are processed. Have you tried sorting out? You can see how much of the variance you can account for by previous activity state.
Previous activity. I mean, like in... previous, like a few hundred milliseconds?
Is it a high gamma state or a low gamma state? Do you get predictable changes?
No, we haven't. The dynamic attention that I was talking about last time somewhat gets into that, but that doesn't give us a really good measure of correlations there.
Yeah. I'm just wondering what this curve would look like if you did this with foreign speech that you couldn't understand.
That's an excellent question.
Are you going to show us?
I'm not going to show you because we haven't done a real study of foreign speech.
English language or something.
This is going back to intensity, so there's no understanding per se by the subject.
This does not have anything to do with intensity. And in fact, my next point was going to address both of these, which was this reconstruction accuracy curve. Which looks nothing like the acoustics here. It also looks nothing like the intelligibility. So they both do have they're both relatively flat and then have a relatively sharp drop off, but they're happening at different points. So this intelligibility is everything in the chain. This is the being able to hear the sounds well enough to infer what the words are, given that you know the language and that this is a story you've been listening to and can infer what it was. And this is some ability of the parts of the cortex to phase lock to this large envelope structure. So this is something that is pretty clearly pre-lingual, probably pre-speech, that this is the ability to follow large parts of the of fluctuations in the sound.
That's a bold statement. I mean, that might not be true. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if there would be big top-down effects on this. I mean, either way would be really interesting.
I guess the basis for that is different cutoffs.
Yeah, look at how big it is at -6 when the intelligibility is so poor.
Well, that's subjective rating.
But Jonathan, you also said this is across the whole brain, right? Mm-hmm. And if you look at different recording sites?
There's no different recording sites because the activity spreads so so far. Yeah, the SNR for localizing this is bad enough. We can do it at certain time points. We can do it at certain for our TRF. We can do it at certain places in the TRF, but not in general.
But at that point, did you train different models for each SNR? Was it the same model, say speech and quiet, that then was applied to different noise levels?
Same model.
And the same model, I see. So if you were to train separate models, I guess you would improve slightly. You might improve at -9, right?
You might get better at -9. But see, this makes sense to me even at -9, because at -9, you can still hear that there are fluctuations. You can hear that it is speech. You just can't hear what they're saying. But you can track that there's a loud sound and a soft sound. It's loud, and now you can't hear it, and it's loud.
Suppose it'd be interesting to try some of the phonemic reconstruction models and see how that compares to the SNR change. That would presumably agree.
Well, so I just wanted to point out that the useful of the intelligibility score, even though we had no reason to believe that it would be useful because it's purely subjective, we just wanted to have it in there, is that in this for this one case of -3 dB SNR, when there is enough variability here to be able to track user-reported intelligibility with the reconstruction accuracy, we actually get a very strong correlation. And I will argue that because we also did a similar experiment with noise vocoded speech, and I'm not going to go into the details of this now because I'm running out of time due to the excellent questions we're having here. But a number of these also gave us enough variability that we could do the same thing. And here's recognition score. And in this case, it's not reconstruction. It's something more fundamental. It's synchronization across trials. In this case, it's in the delta band. So this is model free. This is just how much reliability is there in the response from trial to trial. How much information is there that you could come up with a model, whether it was linear or not. And we also get, in the cases where there is enough variability to ask the questions, we also get these correlations. We only get it in the delta. We don't get it in theta or anywhere else in the, that's pretty much all there is in the 1 to 10 hertz band. So this is probably a signature of something that is beyond just sound. Whether it's speech or how close it is to language, I don't know. But the delta seems to match with intelligibility, whereas everything else is just to some more basic acoustic properties. And
how high can you go? Is it below 10 hertz? Do you get enough information about 10 hertz to see?
No, because the trial-to-trial reliability is too poor.
Because we know that gamma oscillations tend to nest inside of delta oscillations.
Yes.
So delta's kind of a packet for it.
We just, every few years, we'll look at gamma again to see what we can see. we can see gamma for driven oscillation. So 60 hertz, for instance, 60 hertz click trains for AMs. We can see that those 60 hertz responses, they're not big, but they're very clean. But if they're just something this subtle, we haven't seen it. And we've certainly looked for envelope modulations of different bands of gamma that we could lock those envelopes to the speech. That would be what we really want to see. That's what's used in ECOG, but I haven't seen it.
So sorry, so if you could go back to that slide with the variation of the both intelligibility and that reconstruction one more back. No.
Yeah.
So you look at that, say, -3 dB point and then show that correlation with intelligibility. I guess you could also, for each individual subject, compute that reconstruction accuracy, see how it drops off and maybe fit it with a sigmoid, or maybe that's not quite enough data, but determine that roll-off point or something, and then see. I guess the question is, so for speech intelligibility, I think people know that more or less it follows a sigmoidal curve, right, like how it drops off. So basically the idea is, that may shift a little bit depending on the individual subject, and then that reconstruction accuracy might shift similarly to that.
I see that I've brought you over to the side that self-reported intelligibility is a valuable measure. But for the most part, it's performed far better than we expected to. So we really haven't been overanalyzing in terms of fitting. And we've seen cases, for instance, where we have where we present the stimuli in a fixed order and then flip the order to counterbalance across subjects, that the intelligibility scores group according to what order they were in. So it's not magic, but in the case where it's truly random, it seems to be useful. All right, so I just also want to mention these other works, especially because of the delta. There are plenty of people out there that are doing similar experiments with MEG and EEG that are looking for to dissociate the acoustics of the speech with the speech-like qualities, for instance, phonemes, or with the linguistic properties of speech as well. And so whenever people do this, they find that they can dissociate them. So it is possible to not just get this monolithic response, but one has to be a little more careful than in the experiments that I've been showing here. This one in particular, Nye's my former student, so I love most things that he does, but I would totally recommend that anyone take a look at this. He's got Chinese syllables, 4 hertz, which are either meaningless, or they form noun clauses and verb clauses, or an entire sentence. And depending on whether they're intelligible or not, you only get the 4 hertz, or you start getting 2 hertz when they form into clauses, or you get this giant 1 hertz when they form sentences. So he's clearly tapping into the structures there that are not just acoustic. All right, so talk. I think aging is worth doing. This is not speech. These are average MEG responses to pure tones. This is the P1M or the M50. This is the N1M or the M100. And I want you to focus especially there, and especially at these peaks, where you can see that the older subjects, the ones in black, are more extreme than the younger subjects. And this is a relatively new phenomenon in terms of being observed, probably just because there hasn't been enough EEG and MEG done to older subjects.
What's the age range for the older system?
Younger in this case was probably mean of 25, 18 to 30, and the older was over 70.
How do you normalize amplitude? Because the gain is sort of hard to control. Between subject the variability is
so
enormous.
When we arrange them by subject, this is what we see. And this is not new. So people have been seeing this in EEG now, especially Claude Alain. So, you can ask, what is the typical M100 or N1 size? And not subject for subject, but typically, it is bigger.
It's so variable, it's very hard to, you have enormous.
This shows the variability we have in our 12 subjects and 12 subjects, or however many there are.
It's with 12 subjects.
But again, this is not new. And this is not speech, this is pure tone.
So each dot is a different subject, each
red dot is a young subject, and they have no correspondence with the black dots that are older subjects because they're different human beings.
So the question is, are these two distributions statistically different?
Right, yeah, and they are.
And they are.
Yeah.
But I think they might be statistically different, but still there's so much overlapping that the question maybe is how relevant it is for
It's not diagnostic.
For example, these things, right?
But you can't look at one of these M100s and say, you are old.
Isn't it because they have less hair? You can get their brain closer to the sensor.
I was thinking less myelin.
So now these are reconstruction accuracies for speech for a number of different SNRs. In this case, it's not stationary noise. It's actually someone talking in the background. And you can see that our younger subjects, depending on which SNR we are around 0.2, you know, going down from up to 0 to as high as 0.4. And our older subjects are better. Their responses are stronger. Their responses to the peaks or whatever it is in the acoustics of the speech stimulus are more reliable. And so we are, you can knock the linear model because it's just a linear model and the brain is clearly nonlinear, but we're getting, for one subject here, 0.5 correlation. I mean, and the student who did this, he's now a postdoc with John Middlebrooks, he could, in many cases, look at one of these response profiles and say, old, old, young, old, old, young. Not with perfect accuracy, but he would just take a look at something and say that person's old.
Is that because it's old people pay attention better than young people?
So why is really not at all clear. This doesn't happen in midbrain. So in midbrain, responses are typically smaller, less reliable, they look noisier. But there's something in cortex where the current theories are that it's an imbalance between excitation and inhibition, which has been seen in other aging studies in animals. In fMRI studies, there's evidence that different cortical areas are less connected. And so this might just be an epiphenomenon of, since they're less connected, the different areas are recomputing the same things over and over again, and it's bigger just because you have more areas.
It could be cognitive effort, and that if the periphery is degraded, you need more effort.
It could be, but
maybe that's what's showing.
For in the speech, but we saw it also in pure tones.
Okay.
And pure tones, they're listening to beeps or beep boops.
So some subjects, especially all, some young ones, show a negative reconstruction accuracy. Is that due to noise then?
Yeah. And that's the reason why in other studies we go to the square of the reconstruction, because having zero is not better than negative 0.1.
Or you might want to have actually to look at what would noise give you and show like a threshold bar or something.
So when we look at these speech reconstructions for younger subjects and older subjects, the older subjects we can do better. And these older subjects and younger subjects, we gave them speech and noise tests. We gave them words and noise, Quixin, Win, a number of different tests, and they have and asked them, do they have problems hearing speech and noise? And they perform worse in general on all these tests, and they have problems hearing speech and noise. All of these subjects, by the way, have clinically normal audiograms. It doesn't mean they have audiograms that are as good as average younger listeners, but if they go to an audiologist, the audiologist sends them home because the audiologist says, we don't need to do anything for you. You can hear all of the beeps and boops just fine. So this is very curious, but it's now just coming through in the literature that older listeners show this overrepresentation in general, and it's so severe that they're even showing it in speech reconstruction. Now, if they're so good, why are they having trouble? So we do have some reason why we think we know what's going on there. Everything we've done so far has been 500 millisecond windows, but we can shrink that, and here's younger listeners. And we're looking at reconstruction accuracy in quiet or when there's a speaker in the background. And we can see that for 500, well, first of all, there's not much difference between speech and noise and quiet for the younger listeners. And they're also pretty flat. You have to go down to about 200 milliseconds or smaller before we have a hard time figuring out what the speech signal was. So there's not, whatever temporal processing is going on in the 200 milliseconds after some acoustic event, that's pretty much all you need. Whereas in the older adults, I mean, at 500 milliseconds, it's much bigger than it is in quiet than it is when there's a competing speaker, and it's much bigger here than it is here. But this 500 milliseconds with a competing speaker starts going down right away. So there's the more processing time the brain is given, the better we are able to reconstruct what the stimulus is, the more faithful representation we have access to that stimulus of. So this seems to be that it's a timing problem, an integration problem, and that when there's nothing else going on, when they're just listening to a speaker in quiet, then that's great, they have whatever time they need. But when there is a competing speaker, then the more time they have they need, the more time they use, but 500 milliseconds is a long time to process an event in speech. So that seems to be what the problem is. That's our guess. That's our hypothesis. And then the last thing I want to show about older listening, and this may be as far as I go because I think it's been 45 minutes, is one of the cognitive tests we do is a visual flanker score, a visual flanker test. We show three digits, 5, 6, 2, and we ask them what the middle digit is. So it's a pretty simple test. But older people and people with cognitive disorders can have these two numbers on two digits on the side interfere with their ability to report what the center is. It's slowed reaction time, but it's also poorer scores. So if you look at the older and the younger, first of all, you can see the older are pretty much only on the left and the younger pretty much on the right. The younger people do better than the older people. But more interestingly is when we look at this reconstruction accuracy, and remember that if you're old, bigger is older, so to speak, that the bigger their overrepresentation is, the worse they do on this test. And this has nothing to do with audition. This has a lot to do with suppressing interfering sensory signals at a pretty high order, digits. So this is something that we're very interested in. And we're in fact pursuing right now the extent that this can be modified, that this is plastic. And that with training, if we can get someone to do better at rejecting interference, can we get their brains to look younger, to have better reconstruction accuracy, and also to do better in speech and noise hearing? We have some, I can say safely, we have preliminary evidence that we can do that, but that's as far as it is. All right, so I didn't get to my last two topics, but I think that's okay. Or last three topics, but I think that's okay. Any questions?
Speech respiration, is it real? Do you get it?
I think it's real. Yeah, I can show it to you afterwards. I have demos and everything.
For the age effect, did you look at, say, separately delta and theta frequency band, and if there are differences or what correlates with that higher representation in older adults?
We didn't see it in that case, but that may be a problem with this, just the signals getting bigger in general being a confound.
In that previous slide, was that reconstruction accuracy on visual test or from the auditory? Or
auditory, speech with a background.
So you're saying their auditory effects correlate with their visual abilities?
Yeah, because I mean, obviously if a brain is aging, it's not just the auditory system
that's aging. Yeah.
I think it's all levels. I mean, we see midbrain degradation. We see this.
Frequency
following response is worse, and it's worse in a funny way. when an older listener, a typical older listener, is listening to a syllable versus in a syllable in noise, the clean syllable looks pretty much like the syllable in noise. It's like it's already degraded by noise by the time it gets to the midbrain, even if there wasn't noise.
Which makes it surprising to get the increase.
But we don't see that in cortex. So whatever's happened by cortex, that smushing, that lowering, that reduction has been amplified. And we of course, we look for correlations among individuals, and probably our subject pool was too small, but we didn't see one way or the other that smaller leads to bigger or smaller leads to smaller. I saw another hand. Yeah.
What is the upshot of what you were going to say in the foreground and background representations section of your talk that you didn't get to?
The upshot of that is when we change the integration windows, not just making them bigger or smaller, but we can change them to focus on higher order processing, plantum temporale latencies versus early processing, Heschel's gyrus. And we can see that the different representations, and this was the question I didn't answer and I promised I would, so I'll answer it now. So if you look at the early, so short time windows, then short time windows, when you try to reconstruct the foreground versus the background or different mixtures, the foreground is not any bigger than the background at these early time latencies. And if you ask, is it more representative of the envelope of the entire sound scene, or is it more representative of, there are, in the case of three speakers, there are three different streams that have been segregated, and we're just looking at the sum of all three of them in some mixture we can't see, it's the envelope of the entire sound scene. So early times, it looks like that the entire sound scene has not been segregated when it's speakers. And we look at the later times, we see definitely the foreground stream, the foreground speaker coming up with higher amplitude. But then we can ask about the other speakers. Have they been segregated out, or is they just one undifferentiated mess? And from the MEG analysis, it's one undifferentiated mess. But that the background is the background. It's not speaker A and speaker B quiet. It's the mess.
But the background is still better than the one mixture after the plantum temporale lag.
It gets harder to, when you're in that later where the foreground has been extracted, it gets harder to model that because one of them now has been amplified, the foreground. And so models then have to then incorporate what that amplification factor is. And we don't want to go, we don't know enough to do that.
You would have a special precision to,
We do it, so this is a paper which, this is an experiment within my lab. We put it out on BioArchive before it's been published, so it was fully available. We also submitted at the same time. It's in review. I can put up a reference to that to do it, to that paper. But we say, let's compare these two things. This one wins. Let's compare these two things. This one wins. All right, having done that, we can ask another question. And so we take it through a few questions.
What I would suggest is, the cookies are waiting outside, so anybody who wants to go, goes. But who's interested, maybe you can give us the rest of the talk, just for a few people, or like a bit informally.
Sure, I'd be happy to do that, but I want to give everyone several minutes to remove themselves so that no one is actually trapped in here.
Exactly, so let's thank Jonathan again now.